This is the audio for March 29th, that's Sunday, March 29th, the PM session. In our last session for Sunday morning, March the 29th, we looked at chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, and just briefly referenced chapter 7, 8, and 9 at the end of the study. What's going on in this context? We are into the period of the judges, not just the death of Joshua, not just the warnings to the children of Israel about being faithless, that is, turning to other gods after Joshua's death, but the actual beginning of a series of judges. We saw the introduction of Othniel in chapter 3, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, that's the end of chapter 3, the beginning of chapter 4, the Song of Deborah and Barak in chapter 5. Chapter 6, we introduced the arrival of Gideon. The Midianites were oppressing the children of Israel. It was so bad that they were hiding in caves and in dens, in hideouts in the mountains. The ability to produce food, that is, to harvest food, was restricted because anything that they planted and attempted to harvest, the Midianites and the Amalekites would come and destroy their produce and so forth. And that affected not only their livelihood, but their ability to feed their livestock. And so all of this happened because the children of Israel did evil in God's sight, verse 1 of chapter 6. And so God's going to raise up another judge. We saw that in three specific instances, four with reference to Deborah, with reference to Shamgar, it just says there was another after him. After him was Shamgar. It doesn't say God raised him up, but that's implicit in the text. And so, unique situation. The angel of the Lord appears to Gideon, and Gideon says, where's the God that helped us during the Old Testament times of the departure from the land of Egypt, that is the Exodus, during the Old Testament times of leading them through the wilderness, and then at the beginning of the period of conquest, where's that God? And so he knew enough to know that those things had happened. How much he believed in them, we don't know, but at least he was aware of them. He wanted to know, where's that God? And it's in this context that the angel of the Lord is going to commission him to be the means through which the children of Israel are going to rebel against and conquer the Midianites. So the oppression that they're suffering now because they're evil, this is the judge that God's going to raise up. And so that's an interesting concept that we don't see anything like that from the standpoint of how any other judge was selected. And so he goes and prepares to offer sacrifice, and when he does so, the angel of the Lord touches it with a staff, and it's consumed. Fire comes out of the rock, consumes the meat, consumes the unleavened bread, and now all of a sudden Gideon, he perceives, this is the angel of the Lord. I've been talking to the angel of the Lord face to face. So he's given a commission, and the first thing that he's supposed to do is to take one of the bulls, the second bull of his father, and go and tear down the altar that's built to Baal, and to tear down and burn the image that's there, and then to use that to build an altar and offer that bull as a sacrifice. And so that's exactly what he does. He does it at night because he's afraid of his father's household and also what's going on in the men of the city. And so he has legitimate concerns. Everybody does it anyway. And so he cuts it down. And so they look for whoever did this, and they find out that it's Gideon. They're ready to kill him. And his father Joash said, well, why don't you plead with Baal? Why don't you let Baal take up his cause? So the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Gideon, and God's going to use him through further preparation to deliver the children of Israel from the Midianites. There's a double sign, a fleece that's due on the fleece once and dry on the ground, and then reverse, I do on the ground and the fleece is dry. And now we get to chapter 7. That's where we left off. And so chapter 7, the entire chapter, details how the army that Gideon amassed was reduced incrementally to only 300 men, and then how Gideon and his men approached the Midianites, and then how they defeated the Midianites. And all of this has God's hand written all over it, providentially, obviously. And so he's referred to as Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, the opening verse. Remember, that means let Baal plead. That is, let Baal contend for himself. And so they got up early in the morning, and all those who were camped and so forth. And the Lord said to Gideon, you've got too many people with you, verse 2. Just too many. I don't want you to assume that the size of your army and your own strength is going to be the means by which you're going to be delivered. I don't want that to happen. I don't want Israel to claim glory for itself, latter part of chapter 2, against me, saying, my hand, that is Israel's hand, has done that. So here's what he says. He says, you tell anybody who's fearful and afraid, let him go back home. And so he does. And so it says 22,000 of the people returned and 10,000 remained. So you can see he started with 32,000 initially. And the Lord said, still too many, still too many. And so the Lord said, here's what I want you to do. Bring them down to the water. I'm going to test them for you. Here's the test. This one shall go with you. The same shall go with you. And whomever I say to you with you, the same shall not go. So it brought him down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink. And the Lord said to Gideon, those 300 men are the ones that are going to do it. So the perception seems to be that they were able to watch what was going on. They were able to be on guard. They weren't fully distracted, that they could still see what's going on, put their hand in the water and pull it back out and so forth without losing a sense of what's going on around them. So God says, these 300, that's the usual approach that's taken to explain this. These are the ones that are going to save you. So how are they going to defeat the Midianites? Well, watch what happens. So they took the provisions, they took their trumpets. Trumpets are going to be key to what's going to happen in a little bit. And they camp near where Midian was, below them in the valley. And it happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I've delivered it into your hand. And watch what you see. But if you're afraid to go down to the camp with Pura, your servant. That is, you can go by yourself, but take somebody with you if you want. And you're going to hear what they're going to say. And afterward, your hand shall be strengthened to go down against them. So he is going to hear a conversation that's taking place among some of the people at the camp of Gideon. So he went down with Pura's servant to the outpost. And when the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, so there's a lot of them there, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore, so just huge army, huge resources. Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. So he hears people in the camp, and the Midianites and the Amalekites, and one of the men is revealing a dream. He says, to my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. Remember, they are in the camp of Midian. It came to a tent, struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. So, well, that's kind of awkward. A loaf of bread, barley bread, came tumbling into the camp, hit a tent, knocked it down. You know, what's that mean? Well, then his companion answered and said, and we don't know where this answer came from, that's not explained to us, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. Now how that man came up with that interpretation, we're not told. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hands. He divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. So you've got 300 men, 300 trumpets, 300 torches inside of pitchers. And he said to them, look, this is what you're going to do. Watch what I'm going to do, and you do likewise. When I come to the edge of the camp, do just what I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who were with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp, saying, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So his contingent, perhaps one-third, we're not told that it's exactly 100, 100, 100 at this point. That's going to be spelled out in the next couple of verses. This is what I want you to do. I'm going to blow the trumpet, and then this contingent's going to blow the trumpet, and the next contingent's going to blow the trumpet. And so you've got 100, 100, 100, and they're going to be surrounded by trumpets sounding. So Gideon and the 100 men were with him. Now we're told that there were 100. Come to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they posted, and they blew the trumpet, broke the pitchers that were in their hands. So now the torches are shining. And the three companies blew the trumpets, broke their pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands, the trumpets in the right, for blowing, and they cried, the sword of the Lord and Gideon. Every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. So it looks from the perspective, this is nighttime. You hear all these trumpets sounding, and you hear all the, see all the pitchers and all the fires, breaking of the pitchers and all the torches lit, and it looks like they're surrounded. They don't know how many people are there. They don't know that it's three groups of 100 surrounding them. And every man stood in his camp, and they all fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion through the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Acacia towards Zerora, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. So the men who had initially come to battle, who didn't go with the 300, now they've got an army that's going out with them. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout the lands of Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites, seize them from the watering places and so forth. And all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places, and they captured two princes of the Midians. Their names are given, Oreb and Zeeb. They slew those men at the rock of Oreb and Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb, pursued Midian, and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. So that's chapter 7. So God obviously is involved providentially and seeing to it that the children of Israel are going to overcome the Midianites. Chapter 8. Look at the review very quickly. First part of the chapter, verses 1 through 28, tells us how Gideon and his men captured and slew the kings of Midian. And then the next part of the chapter, 29 through 32, talks about Gideon's death. Last few verses, once again, show Israel's constant turning from God. So notice, God just delivered them. Now, just as a reminder, when you go back to chapter 6, verse 1, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. The Lord delivered them into the hand of the Midians, the hand of Midian, for 7 years. So this has been going on for 7 years. Through Gideon's selection as the next judge, and his being proved and his army being proved, the children of Israel are able to rout the Midianites, initially by means of surrounding them, and then later after the people spread, the rest of the people join them and they pursue them. So let's look at chapter 8. So the men of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. So this is an issue that's going to show up in the text. In chapter 7, in verse 24, they sent messengers to the people of Ephraim saying, come down and fight against us. All right, and people are going to gather together. And they were asked this question, hey, how come you didn't ask us before to do this? So there's an issue of pride there. You know, we're big enough, we're powerful enough, you could have called us before. And so this is going to come up again in chapter 12, in verse 1, during the time of Jephthah. And so they want to know, hey, you didn't call on us. How come you didn't call on us? You should have called on us. And so he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? So he's going to kind of play up to them a little bit. You know, Ephraim is great. You know, it's one of the larger tribes. Sometimes Ephraim is used, the name of Ephraim is used to represent Israel as a whole. He said, oh, what have I done in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? And so his point is, everything you guys do is great. God's delivered into your hands these princes. What was I able to do in comparison to you? Then their anger toward them abated when he said that. So he played up to them. Yeah, listen, you played a key part. So they were acting as if they were overlooked, and they were hurt a little bit that they weren't called initially. So Gideon comes to the Jordan, he and the 300 men, they crossed over, they're exhausted and so forth. He said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I'm pursuing Zeba and Zalumna, kings of Midian. And the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalumna down in your head, in your hand, that we should give bread to your army? So Gideon said, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalumna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with thorns in the wilderness and with briars. And so they acted like, well, you're pursuing them, but you haven't got them yet. There's a passage, elsewhere that we're going to get to as we go through the Old Testament. Don't speak as if you have proven the armor that you have when you've never even put it on. So it's kind of like our adage, don't count your chickens before they hatch. And so they said, are they in your hand now? You don't have them. They're not under your control now. Why should we give you anything? So he went up from there to Peniel, spoke to them in the same way, and the men of Peniel answered him just like the men of Succoth did. So he spoke to them, when I come back, I'm going to tear down your tower. Zeba and Zalumna were at Karkar. These are the men he's pursuing, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the East. 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. So the size of the army that they're fighting is considerable. So Gideon goes up by the road, those who dwell in the tents, he attacks the army, he pursues Zeba and Zalumna, and he took the two kings of Midian and routs the whole army. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle, right? Caught a young man of the from the men of Succoth and interrogated him. So he's got some questions here. And he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. These are one of the cities where they refused to help him as he's going after the enemy. So he came to the men and said, here are these kings that I've captured about whom you ridiculed me. Notice they were mocking him before. Ridiculed me, saying, are these in your hands now that we should give bread to your weary men? You act like you should have this before. We can see giving you something as a reward after the fact, but you haven't done it yet. So he was en route to do it, and God was blessing him to accomplish it. The point was, they didn't give aid to Gideon like they should have given aid to Gideon. So he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth, which means he disciplined them. He tore down the Tower of Peniel, killed the men of that city. And he said to Zelah and Zalumna, what kind of men were they who killed you at Tabor? All right? At Tabor. And they said, they're just like you, or each one resembled the son of a king. And so his point was, the people, my people, children of Israel that you killed, what were they like? They were valiant men. They were like you as a king. And then Gideon says, those people are my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. And he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. The youth would not draw a sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. So Zeba and Zalumna said, you kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength. So Gideon took their lives and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camel's neck. So now, as incredible as this is, we are going to see one of many unique circumstances in which God uses people to accomplish his will. And those people who are accomplishing his will, they're not always the best. We're later going to see during the time of Elijah and Elisha, the rise of Jehu, a king in the northern kingdom of Israel. And incredible stuff that he accomplishes in eradicating the worship of Baal and eradicating the priests of Baal and the descendants of Ahab and Jezebel and so forth. But he was every bit as wicked as they were. God blesses him in the sense that he allows his sons to reign after him for a few generations. But God uses wicked people sometimes to accomplish his will. It's not like wicked people thinking, we're here to do God's will. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and others who come against the northern kingdom first and then the southern kingdom, they don't come saying, we're here to do God's will. They think they're doing just what they want to do, and they are not playing into God's hand. And so that's going to be interesting as we go forward. So notice, after all this is done, the men of Israel come to Gideon and say, we want you to rule over us. You know, we want you to be our king. Now, this is kind of interesting that they're wanting somebody to rule over them now that he's proved himself. When Saul first becomes king, people are very hesitant to follow him because he's kind of timid, kind of shy, he's head and shoulders above everybody else, a handsome man. But when they go to make him king, inaugurate him as king, he's kind of hiding. And so, you know, leaders of some of the tribes say, this guy's going to be our king? How's he going to fight our battles for us? Remember, the reason why they wanted a king is to have a king fight their battles for them. So now that Gideon has proven himself, remember others said, why should we help you? Why should we help you? Well, they got their comeuppance. We saw that earlier in the chapter. So now that he's proven himself, they say, you rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. So they said, we got a dynasty going here for you, you, your son, your grandson. And Gideon said, no, I'm not going to do that. All right? I'm not going to rule over you. My son's not going to rule over you. Watch this. The Lord shall rule over you. Now, that's a commendable thing for Gideon to say. But lest forget what we just mentioned a moment ago, Gideon's far from being a perfect guy. And we're going to see as we get further into the text that what he does here is noteworthy, but it's not the end of the story. So let's go a little bit further. All right? So that's it in verse 22. So they want Gideon to rule over them, and Gideon says, not going to do that. this is what's going to happen. So watch what we see going forward. All right. So he says, no, God's going to rule over you. Gideon said to them, I would make a request, however. I want you to give me the earrings from the plunder. So they had golden earrings and so forth because they're Ishmaelites. So the answer says, we'll gladly give them. They spread out a garment. Each man threw in the earrings from his plunder. And here's the weight of the gold. What was it? 1,700 shekels of gold, considerable sum. Besides the crescent ornaments, those were on the camels we saw before, pendants and purple robes, which are on the kings of Midian, and beside the chains. Now watch, Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. So Gideon recognized the angel of the Lord, paid obeisance and sacrifice to the angel of the Lord, challenged the angel of the Lord by means of the fleece twice, did God's bidding in winnowing the number of his army down to 300, went after the Midianites, the Amalekites, and defeated them, enlisted many other people to pursue them, slew those kings, took care of those who challenged his authority and were unwilling to help as he's pursuing the enemy. All these things are great from the standpoint of all the things he does. And then in this context, he's told, we want to make you a king, we want to make your son a king, we want to make your grandson a king. He says, nope, God's the ruler. But he says, I will have you do this. Give me all this jewelry stuff. So they open up this garment. And they threw all kinds of things in it. And it's described here, and its weight and its value is given. And what does he do with it? He makes an ephod, sets it up in the city, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, became a snare to Gideon and to his house. So, thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. But some of that time that it was quiet, Gideon is involved in perpetuating this false system of worship that he set up in verse 27 and 28. So, Gideon's going to die, down to verse 29. Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. That's Gideon. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. So this is an issue that we're going to talk about later as we get into the text. Multiplicity of wives gets way out of hand, and it's going to culminate in what we see in 1 Kings chapter 11, 1 Kings chapter 12, with reference to Solomon. And so he had a concubine who was in Shechem, also bore a son, and his name was Abimelech. Now, concubine means it wasn't a legitimate wife, but it was still his from the standpoint of having her as a pseudo-wife, so to speak, a concubine. And she had a child. The child's name is Abimelech. Now, Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age. He's buried in the tomb of Joash, that's his father, in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And it was so as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals. Now, just remember, they were involved in harlotry to the ephod that he made. That doesn't show any connection in this immediate context to the Baals, but when he dies, they go right back to what they were doing before. All right? Played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. All right? So the children of Israel did not remember, verse 34, the Lord that had delivered them from their hands on every side. All right? Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accordance with the good that he'd done for Israel. What does that mean? Remember, the beginning of the chapter, change that in the middle of the chapter, they wanted to make Gideon, Jerubbaal, king, his son king after him, and his grandson king. But now, at the very end of it, they don't remember everything. So, watch what we see. So Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, now this is not one of the sons of the wives, but he was the son of a concubine. And so there's a sense of illegitimacy, of course, that applies to him. And so he goes to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, with all the family, the house of mothers of his mother's father, saying, please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all the 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember, they were wanting a son of Gideon to reign over them. He said, but there's 70 of them. That's going to be kind of confusing. Wouldn't it be better if there was just one? And so they said, which is better? He says, remember, I'm your own flesh. I'm your own bone. So his mother's brother spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of the heart of the men of Shechem, and their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he's our brother. So let's kind of consolidate around him. He's the candidate running for king, so to speak. So they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. So he's conned his half-brothers to follow after him. And he says, it's going to be better if just one of us is going to, you know, lead the way here. And so they pay him money. He takes the money, hires worthless men. So he goes to his father's house and he kills his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal that we saw introduced in verse 30. He kills them all. Kills them on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself. So he missed one because he hid. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. So here's the point. He is a bastardized son, as it were, an illegitimate son of Jerubbaal Gideon through his concubine that was at Shechem. And so he consolidates his power by telling all the brothers, say, hey, let's all work on this together. And they all pitch in with him. And he takes the money, hires people, and he kills them all. Kills them all, with the exception of one. That's going to come up later. All right? So all these men of Shechem, they're going to make him king. So now it was told Jotham. Who's Jotham? All right, Jotham is the youngest son of Jerubbaal, who hid himself and was not slain. When it was told Jotham what he did, he goes to the top of Mount Gerizim. That's one of the two mountains when they came into the land. Mount Gerizim was the Mount of Blessing. Mount Ebal was the Mount of Cursing. And he cries out and says, then listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Now, this is an interesting parable that we see. He says, the trees went forth to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign over us. The olive tree said to them, should I cease giving my oil, you know, to hold sway over the trees? So the olive tree says, not going to do it. So there's something significant about the order of the trees that are presented here. There's something of great value to the olive tree. I'm not going to stop being an olive tree to hold sway over the other trees. My point is I have a place, and I'm not going to go outside of my place in order to be something other than what I am. So then the rest of the tree said to the fig tree, will you come and you reign over us? And the fig tree says, I'm not going to stop yielding my sweetness and my good fruit to be king, so to speak, over the other trees. So that's two. Notice each of these significant trees in their own right, serving a dedicated purpose to honor and glorify God. In the illustration that's here said, we're not going to leave what we're doing to become a king of trees. All right. So then the tree said to the vine, all the rest of the trees said, you come and reign over us. And the vine said, nope, not going to do it. I'm not going to stop bringing forth my new wine to sway over the others. But then finally, so there's three. Right, the olive tree, the fig tree, and the vine, none of them said, we're not going to stop being what we are. We're not going to be filled with our own pride and glory and rule over the rest of the trees. Okay, obviously trees don't reign over other trees, but here's the illustration. Each of them recognizes their place and their purpose. But then it says, all the trees said to the bramble. What's that? You know, just imagine a worthless bush. If you're out in the west, it'd be a tumbleweed, so to speak, you know, worthless. You come and reign over us. So it doesn't have the ability to produce olives and the olive oil that comes from that, or to produce figs, the sweetness that comes from that, or produce what the vines can, the new wine and so forth. So the bramble said, yeah, let's do that. The bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me king, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. So notice, the cedars of Lebanon are grander than all the others. They're very noted from the standpoint of the significance of size and strength and being used as building materials. That's going to come into play with Hiram, king of Tyre, who helps David and then Solomon harvest all of these trees for the incredible building project that's going to be the temple. And so the bramble, the worthless tree, assumes the right of being the king of all the other trees. All right, so that's the point that he's making. He's mocking Abimelech, saying, you're not worth anything. All right, you have no right to do this. You're not as important as the olive, as the fig, as the vine. You're but a bramble. All right, and you're assuming this role, the role of king. So verse 16 says, if you acted in truth and sincerity, make Abimelech king. So this is Jotham crying out to the men of Shechem. He says, if you've done this, you've made this worthless guy, this bramble king, if you've dealt well with Jerubbaal in his house and have done to him as he deserves, for my father, remember, he's a son of Gideon, also called Jerubbaal. My father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian. So he demonstrated and merited your reverence and respect for him because he fought for you. What is Abimelech done to get you to yield your reverence to him? He's killed 70 of his own brother. Not exactly parallel to what Gideon did. But you've risen up against my father's house this day, and you, they were complicit with Abimelech in doing this, you've killed 70 of his sons. You know, how in the world is that showing reverence and respect to my dad? All right? And you made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, notice he's pointing out that he's an illegitimate son, you made him to be king. He said, if you've acted in truth and sincerity with reverence to my father, Jerubbaal, and rejoice in Abimelech, then let him rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come down from Abimelech and devour the man of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come from the man of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. So I hope you both burn yourselves up, so to speak. So he runs away and he flees, right? So after Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, remember, he's the appointed king by the men of Shechem. He cons them into that and so forth. God sent a spirit of ill will between the men of Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with them. So what he said before is that you're going to end up killing each other, back in verse 20, and it's going to happen. That the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be settled, and their blood be said, be laid on Abimelech, their brother who killed him, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in the killing of his brothers. So they're complicit with each other. He says, I'm going to hire you, I'm going to pay you with the money that these guys gave me, because I said, let's consolidate everything. Rather than having 70 kings, let's have one, and I'll be that guy. Yeah, yeah, we'll do that. Use that money, hire these guys, and had his brothers killed. So the men of Shechem set an ambush against him. Verse 25. Right, and how this is going to play out is spelled out in the rest of the text here. They robbed everybody's passing along the way. Gael, the son of Ebed, comes with his brothers, went to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So they went out into the fields, gathered grapes from their vineyards, trod them, they made merry, and they went into the house of their god, ate and drank, and cursed Abimelech. Then Gael, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech? All right, they're all a little tipsy now. They're full of wine. Who is this guy that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? So he's kind of fomenting an insurrection here. If only this people were under my hand. You know, this is kind of like what we're going to see Absalom doing during the time of David, the second king. If I were king, this is what I would do. So he's playing the same part here. So this is Gael, the son of Ebed. This is what I would do. So he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words, and his anger was aroused. He sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, listen, this guy, Gael, the son of Ebed, and his brothers, they've come to Shechem, and here they are. They're fortifying the city against you. So now, Gael, the son of Ebed, he's kind of got people in the city of Shechem who were initially in allegiance, aligned with Abimelech. He's got them kind of, you know, coming up to him. He's currying favor with them. So get up by night, you and the people, and it shall be as soon as the sun is up, you know, go against them, rush the city. So Abimelech and all the people with him rose by night and laid in wait against Shechem and four companies. Gael, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the gate. Abimelech and the people with him rose from lying in wait. And when Gael saw it, he said, look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains. But Zebul said to him, you see shadows in the mountains and as if they were men. He spoke again and said, no, people are coming down from the center of the land. And another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree. So, you know, Abimelech's armies are coming. And he said to him, where indeed is your mouth now with what you said? What's Abimelech? That we should serve him. Are not these the people whom you despise? Go out, and if you will, you fight against them. So he's wanting people to come to his aid and fight against Abimelech. He spoke big before, but when the challenge came, he didn't seem to be as bold. So he goes out leading the men of Shechem, and he fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, fled from him, and many fell wounded even to the gate. So Abimelech dwelt at Arumah, Zebul drove out Gael and his brothers. So there's fighting going on. What was once united around Abimelech, the illegitimate son of Jerubbaal of Gideon, you know, there's there's a lot of dissension, a lot of stress that's there. So you keep going, fights against the city, takes people, kills the people, demolishes it, sows it with salt and so forth. Now drop down to 46. When all the men of the Tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Bereath, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of the temple are there. So he went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people with him, took an axe in his hand, cut down a bough from the trees, and took it and laid it on his shoulder. So then, who were with me, what have you seen me do? Make haste and do likewise. So what they do, they're going to make battering rams, all right? And they're going to lay them against the city and set it on fire. Put them against the stronghold, set the stronghold on fire by them, so that the people, the Tower of Shechem, died about 1,000 men and women. All right, so I mistakenly said battering rams. Made use the wood that he got to set them on fire. That is the tower where they were hiding. So he went against Thebes and camped against a strong tower. All right, all the people fled. They went up to the tower, and so he's going to do the same thing. Do near the door of the tower to burn it. And a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech, talking about the grinding wheels that they used, and it crushed his skull. He called quickly to his young man, his armor bearer, and says, "You kill me, because I don't want anybody to find out that a woman has killed me." And that's what happened. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed. Thus, God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father, Gideon/Jerubbaal, by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem, who helped Abimelech do this, God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, which said, "You're nothing but a bramble. God's going to take you out." All right? So we are now at the end of the Gideonite saga. Chapter 6, introduction of the Midianites oppressing the children of Israel. Gideon's introduced. He's convinced that the Lord is speaking to him. He worships the Lord. He destroys the altar of his father. He is convinced by means of the sign of the fleece. He goes after the Midianites, the Amalekites, with the 300, and then an army goes with him after that. And then finally, in the 8th chapter, the Midianites are subdued, and he's not going to be made king. Just give me all this money instead, which they're willing to do. Builds an ephod with it. That's part of his contribution to the harlotry. And then when he dies, we see the conspiracy of one of his children, the illegitimate child of one of his handmaids, Abimelech, who's going to conspire with others that he hires with their own money of the other 70 brothers, and has those 70 brothers killed. Jotham, the one that's alive, uses this incredible parable saying, "You're worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless. You have no value like the olive, the fig, or the vine. You're just a bramble. And you think you're gonna destroy the cedars of Lebanon. They're much greater than you are." So ultimately, he calls out both the people of Shechem who came to the aid of Abimelech. And they both end up receiving their just desert, so to speak. So that takes us through chapter 9. All right, chapter 10. I don't think we went through the survey. Yeah, let's very quickly hit the survey. Abimelech, one of the sons, established him as king. Slew all of his brothers, with the exception of Jotham. That's the first 6 verses. Jotham rebukes Abimelech and the people of Shechem, the Shechemites, for allowing him to do this. And so you've got this huge prophetic utterance with regard to the destiny of Abimelech and Shechem. That's the whole olive, fig, vine, and bramble illustration. Then an account of the conspiracy of Gaal against Abimelech, his exile from Shechem, as well as the demise of those in the tower, and then the death of Abimelech. And all of these occurred just as Jotham, the illegitimate son of Jerubbaal Gideon, said. All right, chapter 10, first 5 verses teach us that 2 more judges reigned over parts of Israel, Tola and Jair. That was pretty quick. We saw Shamgar's introduced and exits in one single verse back in chapter 3, verse 31, before Deborah comes on the scene. And so these guys come and leave very quickly. Not very much significant mention about them. 2 verses dedicated to Tola in verses 1 and 2. And Jair is introduced in verse 3, 4, and 5. And then he's gone. And so we get next to Jephthah. Big story when we get there. All right. So first 5 verses tell us about the next 2 judges, Tola and Jair. verses 6 through 18 tell us again about the sins of Israel. This is not the first time. This has happened again. They did evil in the sight of the Lord. They served other gods. They cried unto the Lord, saying, save us. They acknowledged their sin. God reminds them of their previous deliverances and told them to go to the gods which they worshiped before. God says, hey, why don't you let those gods that you're worshiping, let them help you. And so they realize, hey, we've done wrong. We've offended you. We've sinned against you. And they acknowledge their sin, and then they put away their gods, right? So that's what we're going to see as we work our way through this chapter rather quickly. All right. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola. He judges Israel 23 years. He died and was buried. After him rose Jair. He's going to judge Israel for 22 years. Had 30 sons, rode on 30 donkeys, had 30 towns, and so forth. He dies and buried as it came on. Now notice it does not tell us who they reigned over. I mean, not reigned over, who they defeated or who they prevented from reigning over the children of Israel. What the enemy was doesn't tell us, whether it was the Midianites, the Philistines, the Ammonites, Moabites, or anybody like that. They're simply not told us in this immediate context. Then after that, verse 6, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, served the Baals, the Asheroths, and it's expansive. The gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammon, gods of the Philistines, and they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. Notice, that's significant. In many other contexts, they are still making pretense of serving God. But here, they're serving not God plus, they're serving them and not God. So that's very significant to note. So the anger of the Lord was hot against them, sold them into the hands of the Philistines. That's going to be one of their arch rivals that we're going to see multiple times. In the period of the judges and going into the period of the kings, they were arch enemies of both Saul and David in the early days of the United Kingdom. Sold them in the hands of the Philistines. From that year, they harassed them. Now watch some of the things that we're going to see in this context, and more is coming. Harassed them, sold them in the hands of the Philistines and the hands of the people of Ammon. So Philistines are on the west and the Ammonites are on the east. All right, all the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites and Gilead. Remember, there's 2.5 tribes there. So they're oppressed in multiple directions at this time. From that year, they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years. All the children of Israel were on the other side of the Jordan. All right. Moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah, against Ephraim, against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. So notice this is a little bit more far-reaching, more widespread than what had appeared before to be regional issues where God's people were challenged and God raised up a judge to defeat those people who were oppressing them. So this is a little bit larger, a larger scale. So the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, we've sinned against you, we've forsaken you, and served the Baals. And now watch what God says, verse 11. The Lord said to the children of Israel, did I not deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the people of Ammon and from the Philistines? Haven't I done that before? Also the Sidonians, haven't I done that before? And the Amalekites and the Maonites oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I delivered you. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I'm not going to deliver you anymore. God says, been there, done that. All right, so go cry out to those gods, he says in verse 14. Let them deliver you in your time of distress. And the children of Israel said, well, we've sinned. Do to us whatever seems best, only deliver us. Well, whatever price we got to pay, we'll pay it. Just take care of us, save us. So they put away the foreign gods. Why? Their lives are dependent on it. They didn't do it free of their own free will. They did it only in the context of God saying, you've given up on me. Why should I help you? Go to your gods. Well, those gods aren't real. All right. You may pretend that they're real, but they're not real. And he couldn't endure them any longer. So the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled together and encamped in Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, who's the man who's going to begin the fight against the people of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Let me just remind you, when you go back to the very beginning of the book of Judges, it starts in a similar way. How is that? It says in verse 1 of chapter 1 of Judges, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass, the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, who shall be the first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? Judah said, and the Lord said, Judah's going to go up. All right? Indeed, I've delivered the land into his hand. Something similar in this context. Who's the one who's going to go up and fight against these people who are oppressing us? He's going to be head over the inhabitants of Gilead. All right, chapter 11. First part of the chapter, verses 1 through 10. provides the background of Jephthah and the account of his selection as the leader of the children of Israel against the Ammonites. Following section, verses 11 through 28, contains the account of the message which he sent to the king of Ammon. More about that when we get there. 15 through 22 traces the history of the relationship between Israel and Ammon with regard to the land under question. So there's some historical stuff that's going to be mentioned in this context. Who owns what, where, and why, and when? So note that Jephthah in this context gives proper credit to the Lord for being the one who dispossessed the former inhabitants of the land. That is, he did not allow any of the children of Israel to take credit for something that God had done. And note also in verse 28, in which Jephthah told the king of Ammon that it would be sinful for him, that is the king of Ammon, to war against Israel. All right? So that's going to make more sense when we get into the context. So then the last part of the chapter, which we're going to get to, is about Jephthah's vow after Jephthah's victorious. And that's been very difficult for people to understand. So I'm going to just look at the notes here and survey them very quickly, and we'll cover it in a little bit more detail when we get in the chapter. Following verses presented great difficulty to biblical scholars. Greatest question, of course, is this. Did Jephthah offer his daughter as he vowed? Or was he somehow or another freed from his hasty vow? All right? We'll talk about the hastiness of the vow when we get there. In consulting the following commentaries, I note them, Clark, Barnes, DeHoff, Zur, Morgan, Wycliffe, Ellicott, I've observed that there's a 50-50 split as to the meaning of the passage. The questions needing answers are, was Jephthah intending to offer a human sacrifice or just any sacrifice? Does the literal Hebrew use the conjunction and, or does it use or? More about that when I get there. Did Jephthah's daughter realize the true meaning of the vow? Was his daughter committed to perpetual virginity, which is one claim that's made, in fulfillment of the vow, or was she literally sacrificed by her father? Would such a sacrifice have been acceptable to God if it did indeed take place? Of all of the questions, only the last one can be answered with absolute certainty. No, God would not have accepted such a human sacrifice, did not allow Abraham to kill his son Isaac, never ever demanded that, indeed railed against the kings that we're going to see in the future and the others who were involved in worship systems of false gods where human sacrifices were offered. That's going to come to play during the time of some of the most ungodly kings, Manasseh being the specific one that I have in mind. So that's an abomination in God's sight. Provided one of the reasons why Israel is to drive out the inhabitants of the land. Why? Because some of those people did that. In this light, consider another question. Would Jephthah, if he did intend to offer a sacrifice, his daughter's a sacrifice, had been wrong if he did not carry it out? Remember, he vowed to do so, and once a vow was made, it was obligatory to keep the vow. See the passage in Deuteronomy in 30. So, verses 32 detail the eventual victory of Jephthah over the Ammonites. I'll mention it in more detail when we get there. As horrendous as it sounds, if he did, which I think he most likely did, and that's in my humble opinion thing, but I think the text demands that, it wouldn't have been that much of a surprise at all. You might say, well, what do you mean? You know, he was a judge that God appointed to allow him to defeat the enemies of Israel. Yeah, so was Gideon. Yeah, so was Gideon. Gideon, who instituted his own false system of worship. And so that he was used as a judge to vanquish God's enemies does not preclude him from offering his daughter as a sacrifice. So let's go through the chapter 11. And then we'll take a break and get into more material in a latter session. So chapter 11, we surveyed it from our notes. Jephthah is born. He's a man of valor. But notice another issue. We saw this with reference to Abimelech, who was a child of a concubine of Gideon / Jerubbaal. Gideon was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. All right? And so Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man. He was the son of a harlot. Gilead begot Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out. Why? You're not part of the family. You are dad's child, but you're not mom's child. All right? You're not one of the wife's sons, is the point. Not just that there's a particular singular one. All right? When his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, you're not going to have any inheritance in our father's house for you, the son of another woman. All right? See, this issue brought up multiple times in the text. Just go back to Genesis chapter 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, where you see the issue with reference to Abraham's wife, Sarah, and her handmaid, Hagar. And so problems always are often presented in the scripture, and there's a multiplicity of wives about how they are treated, about also how their children are treated. So you're not going to have any part of us. So what did Jephthah do? He left. All right, he's going to leave. And so he starts hanging around with a bunch of, you know, ne'er-do-wells, scalawags. Text says worthless men banded together with Jephthah, and he went out raiding with them. So he becomes a robber, all right? Jesse James of the Old Testament, so to speak. Came to pass after a time that the people of Ammon made war against Israel, all right? And so it was when the people of Ammon came against them, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah. Why were they going to get him? Well, he's a bandit. He's the Jesse James of the Old Testament, so to speak. They said, we want you to come and fight for us. We want you to help us defeat the Ammonites. Well, that's kind of interesting. Remember, he was sent away, so to speak, saying, we don't have anything to do with you. You're not our mother's child. You're our father's child, but that's it. We don't want to have anything to do with you. So they came to him, and they said to Jephthah, we want you to be our commander, verse 6. And Jephthah said, really? Aren't you the ones who hated me? Aren't you the ones who expelled me from my father's house? Now you've come to me in your distress? You know, what's up with that? So the elders have said, well, that's why we've turned to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the people of Ammon and be our head. So remember, when Gideon vanquished the enemies, the Midianites, the Amalekites, the people said, we want to make you a king and your son king, your grandson king. No, I don't want to have anything to do with that. Other heirs crept in, saw that already. So they said, we want you to be our head. So Jephthah said, okay, if you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon and the Lord delivers me, shall I be your head? And they said, yes, God's our witness. All right, look at verse 10. The Lord's going to be witness between us if we don't do according to your words. So Jephthah went with him, and the people made him head and commander. And Jephthah spoke all these words before the Lord in Mizpah. So Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, saying, what do you have against me that you've come to fight against me in my land? And the king of the people of Ammon answered the messenger. So we've got a lot of letter writing going on here, messengers going back and forth. Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and to the Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands peaceably. So there's a land dispute here. The king of Ammon says, you took this from us. We had it first. Jephthah sent a message, verse 14, said, nah, that's not what happened. Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the people of Ammon. For when Israel came up, so here's a history lesson, from we came up from Egypt, we walked through the wilderness as far as the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, all right? Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, said, let us pass through here. So if you go back in the Old Testament text where this is referenced in Numbers and so forth, you'll see that, Jephthah is providing an accurate history recall here. So this is what happened. We sent messengers saying, let's pass through. The king of Edom said, no. In like manner, they sent message to the king of Moab. He said, nope, can't do that. So they remained at Kadesh. So they went along through the wilderness and bypassed, notice verse 18, bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab, came to the east side of the land of Moab, and encamped on the other side of the Arnon. But they didn't enter the border of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. The point is, we asked for permission to go through these properties, and we were denied. So we skirted around them, never entered them. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon. This is one of the kings that they defeat on the other side of the river, Og and Sihon. To Sihon, king of the Amorites. Now remember, this is a conversation that he's having with the king of the people of Ammon, but he's talking about the Amorites. And Israel said to him, let us pass through. Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through, so he came to battle against them. All right, Sihon didn't trust them. He gathered all his people and camped against Israel, fought against them, and the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. Thus Israel gained possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited that country. So we asked for peaceful passage. It wasn't granted to us. The guy came against us. We defeated him. That's how this happened. Then they took possession of all the territory of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Jabbok and from the wilderness and so forth. So now the Lord God of Israel has dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. Should you then possess it? So we've had this because we defeated, going back in history, to the time when they came out of the wilderness and defeated Og and Sihon before going into the land of Canaan and fighting against the city of Jericho and then the city of Ai. So we're not going to give it back. You know, we conquered this some time ago. Will you not possess whatever Chemosh your God gives you to possess? That is, if your God allows you to possess a land, are you going to give it up? Our God allowed us to do this. Verse 24. So whatever the Lord our God takes possession of before us, we will possess. So this is a God thing. God did this for us. We're not going to fight against God. This is what happened. And now, are you any better than Balak? That's interesting. The son of Zippor, the king of Moab. Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? So while Israel dwelt in Heshbon, its villages in Aroer, and its villages in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them then? All right. Therefore, I have not sinned against you, but you wronged me by fighting against me. May the Lord judge against you. However, the king of the people of Ammon did not heed the words with Jephthah sent him. So, what's going to happen? Verse 29 and following. Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He passed through Gilead, Manasseh, passed through Mizpah and Gilead, Mizpah of Gilead, went to Ammon, and he made a vow. And here's what he vows. If you're going to deliver this people to my hands, the people of Ammon, whatever comes out of my doors when I get home, I'm going to return in peace. I'm going to offer that up as a burnt sacrifice, burnt offering. What he intended, what he thought is debatable, obviously. So he advanced against the people, fight against them, deliver them into his hands. He defeats them, all these 20 cities, with a very great slaughter. So here's the interesting thing that we see at the end of the chapter. When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there's his daughter coming out of the house to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was the only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. It came to pass when he saw her, she's the one who comes out of his house, he tore his clothes. He says, "Alas, my daughter, you've made me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I've given my word to the Lord, and I can't go back on it." So she said, "My father, if you've given your word, do to me according to whatever has come out of your mouth, because the Lord has avenged you of your enemies." And then she said to her father, "Let this thing be done. Let me alone for 2 months. I may go and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I." So he said, "Go." And he sent her away for 2 months. And she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity. At the end of that 2 months, she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. General meaning of the text, without going into lots of complicated stuff, is he vowed to have his daughter sacrificed, and he kept it. That's what the text seems to indicate very plainly. I know that's an incredibly uncomfortable thing for us to understand, but that's not the first time that we read something very uncomfortable in the book of Judges, and it's definitely not going to be the last. So I want to talk about that more as we take up this before we get into the next section of the text of chapter 12. So we've gone just about an hour, just a little bit less than that, but I want to take up at that point in chapter 12. And if we can, in the bonus lesson, I'm going to call it, I want to finish the rest of the book of Judges, which is going to take us up to chapter 21. So we've got about another 10 chapters. I'm going to have to be a little bit less wordy when we go through the text. But hopefully we're spending a little bit more time on this because we have the opportunity to do so. And because we're not doing it, if we're doing this in class, meaning at the building in the AM PM sessions, we'd be rushing and not devoting as much time to the development of each of these chapters as we are now. So there's a benefit, an odd one, so to speak, in that we have that much more time to develop the meaning of the text as we can. All right, so we're going to stop here at the end of chapter 11 and take up next time with chapter 12.